Us on the River. I was your host this afternoon, Andrew DeZingle. Don't forget to tune in at 7 o'clock tonight for On the River again with your host, Michelle Bedford. That'll be from 7 to 10 p.m. Now it's time for All Things Considered.
It's the Wild Wild West. You have a Secretary of Health who has undercut the nation's trust.
A leadership vacuum at the CDC as the director is fired and other agency leaders quit in protest.
For Thursday, August 28th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. This hour, the Trump administration wants to build more roads and national forests.
But will more roads lead to more fires?
Forest Service is already suppressing 98% in an initial attack. Putting roads into all the roadless areas isn't going to increase that to 99.
And Mary Louise, you're launching a new podcast today.
I am indeed. It is called Sources and Methods. And on today's episode, our very first, we will tell you why.
Magicians don't tell you how they do their magic tricks, and spies don't tell you about their sources and methods.
A little taste of our new national security podcast after this news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Janine Herbst. Police in Minneapolis updated the number of injured and dead in yesterday's mass shooting at a Catholic church to 20. Two children died, 16 others were injured, and three adults in their 80s were also injured. Minneapolis Police Chief Brian O'Hara says they believe the shooter, Robin Westman, acted alone.
This is an individual who, unfortunately, like so many other mass shooters that we have seen in this country, too often, and around the world, had some deranged fascination with previous mass shootings.
Authorities searched the church and three homes and recovered 116 rifle rounds, three shotgun shells, and one live round from a handgun police say appears to have malfunctioned. Kirsty Marone from Minnesota Public Radio has more.
Many of those wounded in the attack were transported to Hennepin Healthcare's hospital in Minneapolis. Trauma surgeon John Gaken says everyone on the hospital staff pitched in. He describes one nurse manager in particular who came to the emergency department from another unit and helped a frightened child.
And one of the children were very scared and alone because everybody was running about doing their jobs. And she went into the CT scanner with the patient, putting herself basically in the harm's way of radiation, which normally would evacuate the room. She put a little lead on and stayed there and held her hand and held her hair while she went through the scanner so she didn't have to go through it alone.
Officials have not yet established a motive for the shooting. For NPR News, I'm Kirsty Marone in St. Paul.
Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook is suing the Trump administration in an effort to overturn the president's attempt to fire her, launching an unprecedented legal battle that could significantly reshape the Fed's longstanding political independence. It's a first in the institution's 112-year history. Fed governors can only be fired for cause, but what cause is has never been established. Trump says he fired her over allegations that she made a false claim on a mortgage application. Russia is defending its attacks that it carried out on Ukraine's capital of Kyiv earlier today that killed at least 18 people and wounded scores of others. NPR's Charles Maines reports.
Russia's defense ministry said it carried out precision airstrikes on designated Ukrainian military targets, a position that was later defended by the Kremlin. Spokesman Dmitry Peskov saying in his daily press briefing the strikes were successful and the targets were destroyed. That claim stood at odds with the scenes out of Kyiv, where in one case an apartment building was shorn in two from a Russian missile attack burying residents in the rubble. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said the attacks proved Moscow's blatant disregard for U.S.-backed peace negotiations. Peskov countered that Russia's military campaign continues, but Moscow preferred diplomacy to reach its goals. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
This is NPR News. The economy rebounded this spring from a first quarter downturn caused by a fallout from President Trump's trade wars. The Commerce Department says its second estimate of the gross domestic product, the GDP, the country's output of goods and services, expanded in the second quarter at a 3.3% annual pace. That's better than the 3.0% first estimate, as consumer spending, which rose 1.6%, was also higher than first thought. It remains strong, and that helped push the GDP higher. A Philadelphia art museum is suing the Trump administration for terminating a federal grant. The Woodmere Art Museum houses a collection of American art and artifacts dating to the 18th century. It says it needs the money to exhibit its collection ahead of America's 250th anniversary celebrations. NPR's Andrew Limbong has more.
In 2024, the Woodmere was awarded a $750,000 Save America's Treasures grant, meant to help conserve, catalog, and digitize its collection. Then in March 2025, President Trump issued an executive order terminating a wide swath of grants managed by the Institute of Museum and Library Services, including the one received by the Woodmere. According to the lawsuit filed by the museums, since then, other museums in the Philadelphia area have had their grant money restored, but not the Woodmere. The museum is suing Trump administration officials and the IMLS for violating the appropriations clause as well as the separation of powers. NPR has reached out to the IMLS for comment. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
And I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org.
It is 6 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Grand Rapids Riverfest is Saturday, September 6th. This year's lineup, Courtney Barnett, Margot Price, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. Tickets and info at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com. Want to volunteer at the event? Head to GrandRapidsRiverFest.com under Get Involved. Weather tonight, increasing clouds, lows 43 to 56 degrees, cooler in northeast Minnesota.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Today, FBI Director Kash Patel posted on X that yesterday's mass shooting at a Minneapolis church was, quote, an act of domestic terrorism motivated by a hate-filled ideology. Extremism analysts have been looking through extensive materials that the shooter is presumed to have shared on a YouTube account. And some of these experts say the videos do not paint a picture of any motive. NPR domestic extremism correspondent Odette Youssef joins us now. Hi, Odette.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, I just want to start with what specifically FBI Director Patel cites as evidence that this attack was ideologically driven. He claims that, let's see, the shooter made, quote, anti-Catholic, anti-religious references, also expressed animus towards Jewish people and Israel, and that the shooter called for violence against President Trump. Now, how does all of that line up with what you and analysts have found?
So I need to preface this with some caveats. First of all, the FBI has access to far more information than I or any extremism researchers can access.
Sure.
Also, the main materials that we've been able to look at are writings presumed to belong to the shooter. That includes journals, which in this case have been phonetically written in English, but with a Cyrillic script.
Huh.
So analysts are actually still working through to translate those full documents. That said, the picture that's emerging for researchers that I've spoken with is quite different from what the FBI is saying. The FBI is highlighting what it is calling anti-Catholic messages, as well as anti-Israel and pro-Palestinian messages. The materials I've seen include, for example, a picture of Jesus crucified that is mounted onto a shooting target. So perhaps anti-Christian, but not specifically anti-Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And more notably, you know, there is a stew of hatreds here. You know, there is anti-Semitism in there. There's also anti-Muslim references. But the bigger point is that to focus on any single one would be to cherry pick. You know, instead, the overwhelming picture here is of somebody who was obsessed with mass shooters and a specific aesthetic of mass shooters, but not an ideology. The goal was the violence itself and to achieve notoriety through it.
Which seems to echo reporting that you have done on some other school shootings, right? Like I'm thinking of the one at Abundant Life Christian School in Madison, Wisconsin last December, also one at Antioch High School in Nashville in January, right?
Yes, yeah. And back near, you know, the beginning of the year, the FBI actually created a name for this category of violence called nihilistic violent extremism. Before that, the former head of the FBI sometimes used the phrase salad bar extremism, which kind of illustrates how the radicalization isn't rooted in any single ideology or goal, but it's just kind of picking and choosing from different, sometimes contradictory ones. But there's another trend that analysts say may be at play here, and that is really about an aesthetic that dwells on mental illness, meaning these shooters are in online communities that venerate mass killers and where mental illness is something they want people to associate with them. Now, it's not possible to conclude from watching someone's, you know, curated selection of videos whether they are clinically mentally ill or not. But the aesthetic is, that this individual stitched together and presented is a familiar one.
Interesting. Well, I also want to mention that there's been a lot of discussion among some conservatives and the media about how the shooter's gender identity may be relevant here. What do the researchers that you're talking to, what are they saying about that?
So what we know is that in 2020, there was a court order pertaining to a request to change the shooter's name from Robert to Robin. It was noted that the applicant identifies as female. Now, the numbers simply don't bear out the idea that trans people are responsible for a disproportionate number of mass shootings in the U.S. Mm-hmm. If there is a link, it may be that trans people may be vulnerable to online radicalization in ways that are different from other people.
That is NPR's Odette Youssef. Thank you, Odette.
Thank you.
Okay, let's catch up with what is happening at the CDC. We know that this week, Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. told the new director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to resign. We know Susan Menares refused, according to her attorneys. Now the White House says she has been fired. Some of the CDC's top career scientists have resigned in protest. And this afternoon, CDC staff gathered outside headquarters in Atlanta to honor their service.
Thank you so much. Thanks for coming out. Thank you.
And NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin is on this story. Hey, Selena.
Hi, Mary Louise.
So tell me about these senior leaders, what we know about the staff showing them support there today.
Yeah, so the group being honored this afternoon included three high-level scientists who've worked in public health for decades. I've heard them described as the backbone of the agency. They say they coordinated their resignations to draw attention to political interference in CDC's science. Now, staff had planned to clap them out as they left CDC today, but security personnel escorted them out in the morning instead. Staff gathered anyway, and the leaders walked down a sidewalk with people lining up to cheer them. There were signs and chants, and all of this took place at a pharmacy across the street from CDC campus, which is striking because earlier this month, that pharmacy is where a gunman stood to shoot hundreds of bullets into CDC, killing a police officer. Investigators say he was motivated by vaccine distrust, and some of the CDC buildings still have bullet holes in them.
Wow, what an image of things unfolding in Atlanta today. You said, Selena, that these departing scientists coordinated their resignation to draw attention to political interference. Can you be more specific?
Yeah, it really seems like a big part of the dispute here was over vaccine policy. So Secretary Kennedy promised senators he was not going to make radical changes to federal vaccine policy, given his background in anti-vaccine activism. But that is really what he has done. He fired all 17 members of an outside expert vaccine panel and replaced them with his own handpicked roster. And he changed COVID-19 vaccine recommendations without input from his own expert staff. And it sounds like what happened here is that CDC Director Menares was told to rubber stamp vaccine recommendations from Kennedy's panel, and she refused. She was also told to fire her senior team by Kennedy, and she refused. This is according to her lawyers and Richard Besser, CEO of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, who spoke to Menares yesterday and briefed reporters.
Okay.
When HHS announced that Menares was out, these leaders submitted their resignations. It is not clear if they're exactly the same people that HHS was trying to fire or not.
Well, what else does HHS say? What's their official response to all this?
Secretary Kennedy was on Fox and Friends this morning. He was asked about some of these accusations. He said he couldn't comment on Menares specifically because it was a personnel matter. He also said there was a, quote, deeply embedded malaise at the agency. And he also said this about the senior leaders who resigned.
No, it has not caught us by surprise. Again, I cannot comment on personnel issues, but the agency is in trouble and we need to fix it. And we are fixing it. And it may be that some people should not be working there anymore.
But Selena, what happens now at CDC and beyond? All these top leadership gone.
We are about to find out. I mean, we're in uncharted waters right now. The CDC is the agency in charge of emergency preparedness and response, and public health leaders across the country are just really hoping there is no public health emergency right now with the CDC in such disarray. And there is some discussion happening about logistically how public health works without CDC. You know, the truth is there's no replacement for the federal government, not just in terms of resources, but in terms of legal authority. But I do think philanthropies will try to fill some gaps, so will state and local health departments. We will just have to wait and see how all of this shakes out.
And here's Selena Simmons-Steffen. Thanks.
Thank you.
Grimsby Town, a small soccer club in the UK. So small, I'm going to guess even a lot of soccer fans don't know it.
Maybe not, but so much can change in just one night.
Grimsby have beaten Manchester United!
They were more a united team than Manchester United were.
In the most dramatic circumstances!
This is why I love the game of football, because everything is possible. And that was a true David versus Goliath moment.
That's CBS Sports covering the game.
Manchester United is iconic. Grimsby Town is, well, not iconic. Imagine the Yankees losing to the Durham Bulls.
It all came down to a penalty shootout after the two teams tied 2-2 in regular time. When it was over, Grimsby fans couldn't be happier about the win.
It was banging. We were all buzzing because we love Grimsby and I hate Man U.
That's 22-year-old fan and local Grimsby bartender Lily Crooks. She is a fixture at Grimsby's very own pub, The Barge.
Crooks did not cheer on her team in the stands, even though it was a hometown game.
Listen to the noise from the Grimsby fans.
But she did watch.
I was at home. I was watching it on Now TV. I wish I was out.
The Grimsby Town players are also a bit surprised that they beat one of the most prominent teams out there, as we heard from Sky TV.
How are you processing the fact that you just beat one of the biggest clubs in the world?
It's not sunk in yet.
That is Christy Pym. Pym is not only the Grimsby Town goalkeeper from last night's game against Manchester, but in a total conflict of interest, he's a Man U fan.
I'm a Man United fan, so I'm half fuming a little bit.
Are you?
Yeah, I am, yeah.
Get over it, Pym. You won. Meanwhile, Grimsby's manager had nothing but warm things to say about his team. Here he is on ITV.
But we've got an unbelievable group of players as well, who want to play for this football club, want to live in the area, want to get better every day.
Now, the reason why Grimsby winning over Manchester is such a big deal, well, it all boils down to league placement. Here's more from CBS Sports.
Manchester United have just lost to a League Two side, and it wasn't a game that we witnessed where we can say that they didn't deserve it. It was by luck. Grimsby Town were fantastic from start to finish. Yes,
for fans like Lily Crooks, Grimsby's win was a long shot, but when she was thrilled to see.
Banging mood.
Banging mood. Cheers, Grimsby Town. A true David and Goliath story.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:18, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. People Power Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is your daily dose of phenology, where John Latimer looks back at his nature notes from this date. We receive support from the Northland Foundation, working within Northeast Minnesota, offering grants, small business supports, and programs to help people and communities, working toward a future where everyone feels they belong and can thrive. More at northlandfdn.org.
On today's date, August 28th, in the year 2012, the first high bush cranberry are ripe. But don't worry, you'll have plenty of time to observe them. These are not a very flavorful berry in the fall. And I have heard it said that they just need a couple of frosts in order to sweeten up. Well, I've tried them as late as November, and even later than that. And if you're looking for sugar, the high bush cranberry is a poor choice, because I have never tasted a high bush cranberry that really made me want to have a second. They are bitter or sour, but never sweet. I have heard people making high bush cranberry into various jellies and jams, But it takes an inordinate amount of sugar in order to make those berries palatable. I guess I would just rather have something else. And birds aren't much different. If you watch the birds, you'll see that they'll eat a lot of other berries before they'll turn to the highbush cranberry for a meal. And that is because they aren't very tasty.
PR comes from the station. And from Odoo, maker of business management software with the goal of promoting growth and scaling businesses with efficiency. Learn more about Odoo at odoo.com. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Calais. The Trump administration is formally launching an effort to build more roads in national forests by rescinding a decades-old rule. More roads and fewer forest protections, it argues, are needed to fight worsening wildfires. But as NPR's Nate Rott reports, fire science shows it's not that simple.
There's an old axiom that Alexandra Seifert likes to bring up when she's talking to people about forest management and wildfires.
The Severide principle.
Coined by the late author and CBS journalist Eric Severide, it essentially says many intended solutions create their own problems.
The law of unintended consequences is a very real law.
Seifert is the director of science for the Global Wildfire Collective, a research group focused on connecting fire science with wildfire managers. She's been studying fire for almost 30 years.
And one of the most fundamental concepts in fire, especially in terms of fire geography, is that roads are the dominant place where you see ignitions.
Where there are roads, there are people. And where there are people, there tend to be fires. And Seifert says that's just part of the problem.
Once you construct a road within an otherwise roadless area, it changes the nature of the vegetation.
Instead of unbroken forest with dark canopies, you often get sun-hungry grasses growing beside roads that dry out quickly and are extremely flammable.
So when you add all of these things up together, you get a lot of ignitions along roads.
A study that's still undergoing peer review mapped fire ignitions in national forests over the last 32 years. And it found that's true. Greg Applett with the Wilderness Society is the lead author of the study.
The density of ignitions was up to four times higher within 50 meters of a road than it was in wilderness areas, and roadless areas were close behind.
Applett says his organization, a nonprofit environmental group, expected to see the Trump administration target regulations it doesn't like.
But this time they tried to link the reversal of protections for roadless areas to wildfire mitigation, and it just, we knew that didn't hold water.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture, which includes the Forest Service, did not respond to a request for comment. In its most recent press statement about the proposed rescission, Forest Service Chief Tom Schultz said, for nearly 25 years, the roadless rule has frustrated land managers and served as a barrier to action, prohibiting road construction, which has limited wildfire suppression and active forest management. Matt Thompson is a former research forester at the Forest Service and the vice president of wildfire risk analytics at Vibrant Planet, a public benefit corporation. And he says, sure, you could make an argument for more roads.
Fires that start near roads tend to be controlled more quickly and smaller for obvious reasons of more rapid detection and access.
And he says if roads are managed smartly, built in places where they could be used as a barrier to stop fires or as a way to get crews in to preemptively manage vegetation along them,
you can de-risk that environment. The question is, like, will we have the resources and can we get it done in time so that it's not just a new risk sitting out there?
Part of the reason the so-called roadless rule was created in 2001 was because the Forest Service didn't have the money to maintain the roads it already had. President Trump's budget request for 2026 cuts Forest Service funding by more than 60%.
Just doing away with the whole thing puts us back into the timber wars and stuff like that.
Dale Bosworth was the chief of the U.S. Forest Service under President George W. Bush, so he's familiar with the fights between logging interests and environmental groups. And he says removing roadless protections won't necessarily increase timber production.
The areas that were left roadless were left roadless for a reason.
They were hard to access or didn't have great timber to start with. Today, he says those areas now have recreational value. And the idea that removing their protections will prevent fires?
Forest Service is already suppressing 98% in initial attack. Putting roads into all the roadless areas isn't going to increase that to 99.
A 21-day public comment period for the proposed rescission begins tomorrow. Nate Rott, NPR News.
Okay, so the fastest trains in the U.S. are getting an upgrade. Amtrak's new Acela trains carried paying customers for the first time today on the Northeast Corridor. NPR transportation correspondent Joel Rose was on board the first train from New York to Washington, D.C., and he joins us now from Washington's Union Station. Hey, Joel.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, so lucky you. How was the ride?
Well, it was fun. I mean, even before the train pulled into New York, there were people waiting on the platform at Penn Station just to take videos. A few of them hopped inside for a quick selfie, even if they didn't have tickets. Some of the passengers who did pay were just regular travelers who seemed kind of surprised by the whole thing. But there were also some serious train people who were very excited. I talked to a passenger named Toby Varghese of Ossining, New York, who has ridden the old Acela trains many times over the last 20 plus years.
It's a lot smoother. You don't feel as many vibrations. And it seems to be running much faster on certain parts of the track here. So it's amazing to see the improvements, you know. They're slow, but they're happening. Yeah, it's amazing.
I also talked to another passenger named Beth Goodman, who got on the train in Boston. She says a lot of the riders had their phones out so that they could measure when the train hit its top speed of 160 miles per hour.
The vibe was awesome on the way down because it was just a lot of train enthusiasts. You know, we had our phones out clocking when we hit 160 for the first time and we all celebrated.
Okay, wait, how big of a deal is it to hit 160?
Well, so these trains are slightly faster than the old Acelas, which topped out at 150 miles per hour. So 160, you know, it is faster, if only slightly. These trains are also lighter, they are brighter inside, and they are bigger. They have 27% more seats than the old ones. I talked to Amtrak President Roger Harris, who is also on the train today. He is very happy to finally have these trains rolling after years of delays in design and certification.
What I've heard was how much people appreciate the onboard environment, the bigger windows, the lighting. They find it more soothing and comfortable.
The train actually did hit 160 miles per hour for a few miles while we were talking, though I should note it only reaches that speed a couple of times on the Northeast Corridor in the places where the rails and the overhead electrical wires are modernized. So these trains are actually not going to make the run times between cities any shorter right now. Amtrak is hoping they will in the future when more of that other infrastructure gets upgraded as well.
All right. Well, nevertheless, it's still a big day for Amtrak. But just stepping back, like, how are things looking for high-speed rail in the U.S. generally right now?
It is a precarious time. Passenger rail got a lot of support under President Biden, who famously logged thousands of miles on Amtrak when he was a senator from Delaware. His administration awarded billions of dollars in grants to a high-speed rail project that is under construction in California. Now the Trump administration is trying to revoke federal funding from that project, which is way behind schedule and over budget. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy has called the project a boondoggle, a train to nowhere. Though he also insists that the Trump administration wants to see high-speed rail succeed in the U.S.
Okay, well, like we mentioned, Joel, you're speaking to us right now from Union Station in D.C., which I understand is going to soon be under new management. What's going on there?
Yeah, the Department of Transportation said yesterday it will reclaim management of this station from Amtrak. Secretary Duffy says the department can do a better job of managing the building, which he says is, quote, showing its age. And this is part of the Trump administration's push to exert more control over the nation's capital.
That is NPR's Joel Rose in Washington, D.C. Thank you, Joel.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
For many who left New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, it was too costly to return and rebuild. Others say strong ties pulled them home.
I had to make a choice of either I bring my business back or I build my home. And it was to build my home because that was my heritage.
20 years later, we hear from Ninth Ward residents about why they returned. That's tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News. Thank you.
It is 429, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is National Native News. We receive support from the Lake Country Journal, a magazine showcasing the beauty, landscapes, and people in Lake Country. The February-March issue publishes the winners of their annual photo contests, which are also displayed at the Brainerd Lakes Regional Airport. Submissions accepted all year round at lakecountryjournal.com. Northland Arboretum in Brainerd offers guided hikes the third Thursday of each month at 9:30 a.m. Hikes are 1 hour long, and dogs are welcome on a leash. We receive support from Headwaters Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Bemidji. Huff's congregation strives to build bridges with the community and welcomes all to seek truth, practice love, and celebrate life. Learn more at headwatersuu.org. Now it's time for National Native News here on KAXE KBXE.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Today we're featuring the Northern Arapaho Reentry Program, which is helping people return home from out-of-state prisons and state incarceration to the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming.
People who are coming into prison like have nothing, and so this stuff will be super beneficial.
Terry Smith moves around boxes in her office filled with blankets and other supplies. She's the program's administrator. Smith is a former Northern Arapaho tribal attorney and judge who went through a public downfall, being indicted on drug charges in 2019.
But during that time, I was dealing with like a lot of grief and loss that I had no idea how to cope with, and so I became addicted to opiates.
Due to the pandemic, Smith was out on bond, but eventually went to federal prison, serving 6 months and 6 months on an ankle monitor. Smith says helping clients in the reentry program is a dream job.
Just kind of being gone through the process myself, you know, being charged, being in treatment, being on probation, I feel like I connect on a deeper level with all my clients.
Smith works with people before they even get out of prison for a smooth transition. She helps look for housing, transportation, jobs, and benefits. This day, Smith is driving clients around to appointments, including checking on GED classes.
I just love seeing people get their life back, you know.
Clients Leah Littlefon Whiteplume and Anthony Big Medicine say Smith and the reentry program have been a lifeline.
Some of the challenges that I faced was like trying to get a job. I didn't have any like clothes or shoes when I first got out because what I had was the clothes on my back and that was it.
She helped me get my driver's license, something I never thought I'd actually do. She always there when I need it. She told me from when I first started working with her, she said, you know, I'll help you, but you gotta also put in the effort too. You work super hard, she'll do her best, whatever she can for you.
The program's voluntary and open to tribal citizens enrolled in one of the two tribes of the Wind River Reservation, the Northern Arapaho and Eastern Shoshone. It's also open to tribal descendants who are not enrolled in either tribe and other Native American tribal members. Many in the program say they have faced ups and downs, but are more determined now to stay out of the justice system with the program's assistance, like clients Thunder Little Thunder and Dolan Nido.
I know that I could do this with the help of Terry. Terry's program's amazing. Like, what she does is inspiring. Like, I love her support, how she advocates for us and helps us with the right resources and gets us going on our feet.
When I got out of prison, I was trying to do it all myself, and I realized how hard that was. I think for somebody that's actually getting out of prison and trying to get back on their feet and trying to do the right thing and not just, you know, go back into the criminal mentality that they were in, I feel that this program is very helpful.
Substance misuse is among struggles clients say they have faced, which often led to crimes they were sent to prison for. The tribal reentry program requires sobriety, says Smith.
I'm very loud and proud about my recovery, you know, and I had a really public downfall. So I feel like it's my responsibility to show people that we can get better.
And that's the choice clients like Serena Perea have made.
I have three children. Their father passed away in 2020 from alcoholism. I'm pretty much all they have left. You know, obviously I've made some mistakes, and I just want to show them that I've learned from them so that, you know, in their future, they can take what I have and make something better for their children and generations to come.
This story is a collaboration with First Nations Experience Television with support from the Public Welfare Foundation. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Minutes from downtown Anchorage, the Alaska Native Heritage Center is more than a museum. It's where Alaska Native traditions, languages, and arts come alive. There's always something new at the Alaska Native Heritage Center who support this show. More at alaskanative.net.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Depowering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at SCOL.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. The war in Gaza is approaching the two-year mark. As it does, Israel continues to launch new attacks on a territory that's already in ruins, and the humanitarian situation for Gaza's Palestinian residents continues to worsen. A team of NPR reporters has been focusing on one question. How did we get here? They've been talking to several former senior officials in the Biden administration, all directly involved in shaping U.S. policy on Israel's war in Gaza when the conflict began. And I'm joined now by two of our reporters on this story, NPR's Tom Bowman and Kat Lonsdorf. Hi to both of you.
Hello.
Hey.
If you could just start by telling us why you wanted to talk to former officials from the previous administration.
Well, Juana, we started out with the simple question, how do we get to this point in Gaza? Famine has been declared. And of course, this all started in the Biden administration, the war in Gaza. Now, at this point, Palestinians are now dying from malnutrition, according to health officials there. And we wanted to learn more about what role the U.S. as Israel's strongest ally had in trying to get aid into Gaza to alleviate that crisis.
Yeah, so we, along with our colleague Fatma Tanis, talked to people who were senior officials across the Biden administration and asked them to take us into the rooms where the decisions around U.S. policy toward Israel's war in Gaza were being made from the beginning. And they described strong, sometimes bitter arguments within the administration, with some officials saying not enough was being done to pressure Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to allow more aid into Gaza. Most of these people agreed to only speak with us without their names being used. You know, these were sensitive conversations. And these people were really grappling with the decisions that were made, wondering if they did enough or if they could have done more.
Mm. What were you hearing from them specifically?
Well, there were very tough and intense discussions. One person we spoke with was David Satterfield. Now, he was a Biden administration's special envoy for Middle East humanitarian efforts, appointed just days into the war. And he said that he and other senior officials were asked constantly if they were doing enough. And it's something they still ask themselves.
Our answer was we're not doing enough, but we have prevented famine and starvation. And while that may be a low bar, that is not an insignificant achievement.
This is something we heard, Juana, from a lot of the people we spoke with, basically saying, by definition, we didn't do enough, but we made a difference, and it could have been worse, and of course, now it is.
But, you know, there were others who said that that's just not the standard by which to measure success in a humanitarian catastrophe, like Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen from Maryland, who was putting pressure on the Biden administration from the early days of the war to do more. Here's what he told us.
The Biden administration was totally feckless when it came to holding the Netanyahu government to the standard of American law and the standards that we claim to apply to every other country in the world.
One former Biden-era official told me, quote, none of us were ever satisfied. It was the most heartbreaking work ever, and we never got aid in any amounts that was sufficient.
Interesting. Okay, I want to back up if we can a bit. Let's talk about the early days of the conflict when Israel was reeling from the Hamas-led October 7th attacks back in 2023, which started this war. Israel imposed a complete siege or blockade on Gaza in the days after There was no food, no water, no fuel. What was happening behind the scenes in those weeks and months?
Yeah, I mean, remember October 7th was the deadliest attack in Israel's history. And Biden made his support for Israel very clear afterwards, saying it had the right to defend itself. And at the same time, Israel imposed that siege on Gaza. You know, that's an enclave that is completely walled off, totally dependent on Israel to allow goods in and out. So this was a really difficult situation from a humanitarian aid perspective from day one.
And also, you know, we heard from former senior officials who traveled to Israel around the time, and they told us that the humanitarian assistance component of the war was not well thought out. Some told us there was essentially no humanitarian plan, and the military mission was always paramount. And looking back, some officials told us the U.S. didn't push Israel hard enough on that. And many of the people we talked to spoke about how the U.S. was reluctant to pressure Israel. Biden was very focused on the rightness of Israel's war. And there was a real sense at the time that Israel was being attacked from multiple fronts.
It sounds like you really got an understanding of what it was like behind the scenes in the Biden administration for some really dramatic and difficult months. Can you just describe that a bit for us?
Yeah, everyone we talked to stressed just how hard everyone was working on this issue. I mean, this was round the clock up to the highest level, even often the president himself making phone calls to the Israelis constantly. Essentially, everyone became desk officers, focusing on real specific details, you know, spending hours getting the Israelis to open a specific crossing or turn back on one specific water pipe. And officials told us that this meant that the U.S. was often bogged down in these details and phone calls, sometimes losing the bigger picture of the humanitarian catastrophe. This all led to a lot of frustration with Israel within the administration. You know, heated arguments between senior U.S. officials and their Israeli counterparts trying to get movement of aid.
I remember a time when the humanitarian situation in Gaza was addressed very publicly here in the U.S., and that was during Biden's State of the Union speech back in March of 2024. And in the speech, he announced that the U.S. would be building a military pier to deliver aid off the coast of Gaza. Tell us about the conversations around that.
Yeah, right. You know, at this point, aid groups in Gaza were sounding the alarm bells about an impending catastrophe there, and Israel was still not letting in nearly enough aid through the land crossings. So the U.S. first started airdrops and then proposed that pier, which had all sorts of problems and only ended up operating for about 20 days total. One former official told us, quote, we were in Hail Mary mode. You know, many of the officials we talked to defended those decisions. Others argued that they ignored the strongest tool the U.S. had in its toolbox, which is withholding U.S. military assistance from Israel.
Right. I mean, the kind of elephant in the room behind all of this and all U.S. policy toward Israel is the large amount of military aid that the U.S. provides to Israel.
Right.
No, that's right. And looking back, some officials are still wondering, should we have halted all military assistance? Would that have pressured Israel to open more aid routes? Now, the Biden administration did withhold, remember, 2,000-pound bombs for a time. So could a larger arms halt have changed anything? But the Israelis were pretty blunt in the meetings with U.S. officials when humanitarian concerns were raised, basically saying, if you withhold arms, we'll just go it alone.
I want to end by bringing this back to now, when famine has been declared in Gaza. The situation has just gotten so much worse in recent months. How has the Trump administration handled the humanitarian crisis there?
Well, now the U.S. under the Trump administration largely seems to be allowing Israel to do what it wants. Aid groups on the ground told us that the U.S. is no longer exerting the same kind of consistent round-the-clock pressure on Israel to allow more aid into Gaza as it did under the Biden administration. We reached out to the White House for this story. A spokesperson replied, saying in part that Trump, quote, wants to ensure the people of Gaza are fed.
But, you know, regardless of the administration, one former senior U.S. official told us that they thought the tragedy of Gaza, with a humanitarian crisis that has played out for almost 2 years now, has fundamentally compromised American global standing. They said, quote, it's a stain which everyone in the world sees, even if we don't.
That was NPR's Kat Lonsdorf and Tom Bowman talking about reporting they did, along with NPR's Fatma Tanis. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And there is so much more to their reporting that we could not get into here. If you want to read their story in full, go to npr.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
You are listening to All Things Considered this Thursday afternoon here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is North Star Stories. We receive support from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. The Bemidji Senior Center hosts a Medicare presentation Wednesday, September 3rd at 1 p.m. Learn about the plans available before open enrollment, which begins on October 15th. Support for KAXE comes from the 17th Annual Community Connect, Thursday, September 18th from 11 to 3 at Yanmar Arena in Grand Rapids, featuring over 50 social service agencies providing information on housing, energy, county assistance, and more. All are welcome. More info can be found by dialing 211. Now for North Star Stories here on KAXE KBXE.
This is North Star Stories, voices from where we live. Today in Minnesota,
federal cuts may affect the state's solar energy program. Then, part two of the impact of federal funding on public media. And Minnesota announces a new director for its missing and murdered Indigenous relatives office. I'm Gracie J. The Minnesota Department of Commerce is pushing back against a federal move to cut clean energy funding. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has threatened to terminate Minnesota's $62 million Solar for All grant, a program meant to lower energy bills and expand solar access. State officials say canceling the program would raise costs for more than 11,000 low-income households, as well as eliminate clean energy jobs and stall Minnesota's progress toward reliable, affordable power. Commerce leaders say they're preparing legal action to protect the funds. In part two of our special report looking at the effects of federal funding on public media in our state, Zan Holston tells us about the impact on Minnesota Public Radio and the state's public television stations.
For Jeff Hanks, CEO of Bemidji's Lakeland Public Television, the station's news program is its crown jewel.
Lakeland PBS is proud to present Lakeland News at 10.
That's a nightly live half-hour news broadcast that we've aired for 27 years now, everywhere from Waro down to Wadena, Deer River, you name it. We're covering stories in those regions.
Hank says the program started because commercial stations in northern Minnesota pulled back decades ago. Now, with Congress defunding the CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, communities in the region could be left without dedicated local TV news. Lakeland Public Television is losing 37% of its budget, about $1 million, money that helped pay for staff, equipment, and the basic operations that allow them to grow member support.
So that's why those federal dollars were important, to leverage that local support and provide that service that is so valued here, that local newscast.
Other public TV stations in the state are facing major losses as well. In St. Paul, Twin Cities Public Television is losing more than $4 million in funding, while stations serving Austin, Duluth, and Granite Falls are all losing about $1 million each. That means free, locally focused programming serving those communities is at risk.
As you hear a lot, everything is on the table at this point. It's going to mean the loss of services to some degree.
It's time now for the morning announcements on NPR News.
The situation looks a little different for NPR and its parent company, American Public Media, or APM. CPB funding made up just 6% of its budget, but that still adds up to more than $5 million.
6% sounds like a small number. It's a significant number to an organization of our size and complexity.
Dushan Drew, president of NPR and senior vice president of APM, says the group has already laid off 30 people.
It's people, it's work, right? It's not a rounding error. It's meaningful to us.
The loss also creates a domino effect. Smaller stations across the country buy APM shows like Marketplace. If those stations can't afford them, APM's revenue drops further. While the cuts will hurt NPR, it's still better positioned than many community broadcasters with a statewide network and large donor base. NPR is separate from Minnesota's public TV stations, and both are independent from the state's 17 community radio outlets, stations that rely much more heavily on CPB funds and are now scrambling for new support. Back up north at Lakeland Public Television, Hank said they had some reserve money to float their operations for now. But long term, the loss of federal funding puts their signature program and the communities it serves in jeopardy.
Pretty much all of our discretionary spending goes towards Lakeland News and providing that service. And that service, on a daily basis, Monday through Friday, that impacts so many people.
For North Star Stories, I'm Zan Holston.
You are listening to North Star Stories.
Well, there's a new face heading up the state's Missing and Murdered Indigenous Relatives, or MMIR, office. Guadalupe Lopez, a nationally respected advocate and coalition builder with deep ties to Minnesota's Indigenous communities, is now serving as the department's new director. Before being appointed as the MMIR director, Lopez served for 4 years as the executive director for Violence Free Minnesota, a statewide coalition to end relationship abuse. Governor Tim Walz created the MMIR office in 2021 to address the disproportionate rates of violence, disappearance, and murder impacting Minnesota's Indigenous communities.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. As we end this hour, I want to introduce a new podcast from NPR. We are calling it Sources and Methods. Greg Myrie is one of the NPR reporters who will be joining me, I'm hosting, on Sources and Methods. So I got him to explain the name of the show on the first episode, which drops this afternoon.
Magicians don't tell you how they do their magic tricks, and spies don't tell you about their sources and methods.
Every Thursday, we're going to dig into the biggest national security stories. This week, Greg Myrie and NPR Moscow correspondent Charles Maines join me in looking at the stalled diplomacy between Ukraine and Russia, also the National Guard patrolling the streets here in Washington, and an avalanche of firings throughout the U.S. intelligence community. And every week, we end the podcast talking about OSINT. If you track the intelligence world, you probably know HUMINT, human intelligence. You may know SIGINT, signals intelligence. OSINT is open source intelligence, meaning it is publicly available. It is not classified, but you might miss it if you're not looking. Greg, what struck you this week?
Two words, salt typhoon. This is, according to the U.S. government, a Chinese espionage campaign that was absolutely massive. It started around 2019 as the Chinese allegedly began hacking into big U.S. Phone companies, AT&T, Verizon, and others, looking apparently to get information from a few key people. Now, this came out publicly. The U.S. Law enforcement and intel agencies started talking about it last fall, shortly before the 24 elections, and said that Donald Trump and Kamala Harris were among those being targeted. Mm-hmm. So we knew this was going on. It was not clear that it had been stopped. In fact, it seemed that the Chinese were continuing to do it, even after all these years and even after the U.S. was talking about it publicly. FBI came out this week, said that actually more than 80 countries worldwide have been targeted as part of this program. It's much broader than initially thought. The U.S. may be getting a handle on it, but it seems other countries probably know very little about what's happening in their homeland.
More than 80 countries, same operation? That's huge.
Absolutely. No, they figured out, and you could see how easily it would be to repeat it. If you figured out a way to hack into the big telecoms company in one country, in the U.S., you could probably do it in other countries as well.
Wow. Salt typhoon. Okay, Charles, can you top it?
I can top it with one word, Max. This is the Russian state-backed messaging application. It's a rival to WhatsApp, which has been banned here recently. So, for example, you can no longer make phone calls or video calls on WhatsApp. It comes up all scrambled. Now, Max, this is the Russian-backed version. It's a Kremlin-backed version. It will be pre-installed on all electronic devices in Russia starting in September. Now, critics would say that's also used to track users. In other words, we can track what we're saying, what we're doing. And for those who would say, well, look, I'll just keep it off my device, well, they're also planning to kind of integrate it with all sorts of e-government services. So it seems like eventually, somehow, Max will get you.
Sounds like so many things in the tech world that if the world were run by a benign dictator, it would be such a good idea. By a benign, benevolent dictator, however, I'm not sure I have great faith that that you won't be tracked everywhere you go come September.
We'll see.
All right, I will throw in the thing that got me curious and wondering this week, which is a renaming, a possible renaming. We know that President Trump likes to rename things. We saw that with various military bases here in the U.S. We've seen it with the Gulf of Mexico, which he's directed the U.S. government to call the Gulf of America going forward. And now he is expressing interest in renaming the Department of Defense, the Pentagon. He would like it to go back to being called the Department of War. I went back and looked because I knew it had been called the Department of War, indeed, for many, many years. It was President Truman who changed it, came along at the end of World War II and said, you know, among other things, maybe we should have an institution that's focused more on keeping the peace and try to avoid war going forward. So it was renamed the Department of Defense. And so I am interested in, and I'm going to be asking some questions and trying to report on why a president who is openly campaigning for the Nobel Peace Prize wants to have a Department of War. So that's a little taste from our new podcast, Sources and Methods. It premieres today. You'll find a new episode each Thursday on the NPR app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, this week's Billboard charts are led by the usual hits from Morgan Wallen and the soundtrack to K-pop Demon Hunters. But a song from the 1990s has just made its chart debut 28 years later. NPR's Stephen Thompson has this story.
Radiohead is one of the most decorated bands of the last 30 years. Its members reside in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and albums like OK Computer, Kid A, and The Bends have become classics. But Radiohead has rarely cracked the Billboard Hot 100 singles chart. Its biggest hit was its very first single, Creep, all the way back in 1994. But I'm a creep. Creep topped out at number 34, though it's become a standard of 90s alternative rock. Before this week, only two other Radiohead songs have made the Billboard Hot 100, High and Dry in 1996 and Nude in 2008. But this week, a fourth Radiohead song has just hit the chart at number 91. It's Let Down from the band's 1997 album, OK Computer. There's plenty of precedent for old songs resurfacing in the Hot 100 decades after their release. It can happen for many different reasons. Kate Bush's Running Up That Hill experienced a huge resurgence after it was on the TV show Stranger Things. And NSYNC's Bye 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 charted for a week last year when it soundtracked the opening fight scene in Deadpool vs. Wolverine. In the case of Radiohead and Let Down, there's more to it than that. The song appeared in the first season of The Bear and has recently become popular on TikTok. That combined presence helped drive an increase in streaming. So now, OK Computer, one of the most acclaimed albums of the 1990s, finally has a chart hit to match its reputation. Stephen Thompson, NPR Music.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from UKG, delivering HR, pay, time, and culture products and services, dedicated to helping clients build a great workplace for their people. UKG.com/great. UKG, our purpose is people. From Easy Cater, a business tool for food, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. And from Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. This is NPR.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Begley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. And now a message paid for by the Minnesota Department of Health. Sometimes you just need to talk about it, but it can be hard to find someone who really listens. That's why there is 988, with support that meets you where you are. Confidential and staffed by trained folks who want to help when you need someone to talk to. Call or text 988 or chat online at 988lifeline.org. Itasca Waters continues their Practical Water Wisdom webinar series Thursday, September 4th at noon. This month, learn about stories.